Hi, everybody. Welcome to Buzzing About Romance. I am Leah, and on this episode, I'm giving you a quick shot of romance author spotlight edition. And on this author spotlight, I am welcoming author Cameron Sullivan. Welcome to the podcast.
Hi, Leah. Thank you very much for having me.
Cameron Sullivan was born in Perth, Western Australia. He grew up with the dark fantasy and horror icons of the 80s and went on to study classics and creative writing at the University of Western Australia. After several years working and studying in Italy and the UK, he returned to Australia and settled in Melbourne, which is the best place for Australians who actually enjoy the winter. He works as a copywriter and will easily lose a weekend to a good book, a new recipe, or game of any kind, from tabletop D&D to pub trivia. The Red Winter, which we will be talking about today, is his debut novel. So D&D, big fan.
Yes, I think from like old school D&D from high school days, like the 80s and 90s, huge fan from the tabletop through to the video game adaptations. And I love what a resurgence D&D's had lately, even on one of my favorite games / imaginative enterprises ever.
So my son, he is 14 and he has started playing Warhammer.
Amazing. Yes.
And they love it. Like they go and have, I mean, they don't actually sleep, but they go to a friend's house and we'll play Warhammer for hours. And when he first told me, I was like, what is this madness? He's like, yeah, I have to like create my army and then paint it and my faction. And I'm like, I know nothing and that's okay.
That is okay. And that I haven't played Warhammer myself, but all of these games, there's so much imaginative play involved. And like Dungeons and Dragons, a lot of it's mathematics. Like there are quite complex, especially the deeper you get into the game, with all the dice rolls and sort of deciding what decisions warrant what level of difficulty, all of these kind of mathematics and probability, and people don't realize that that's what they're doing. So I think it's possibly a bit of maybe a gateway drug into mathematics for young people. But love all of those. And again, grew up with all of the, I mean, they weren't the original, I think it was third edition by the time Dungeons and Dragons, by the time I got into it. But so even the books, so the Dragonlance books, shout out to anybody who remembers those. such a big part of fantasy back in those days.
So let's talk horror. Are you a movie buff, book buff, or a like both?
Very much movie and books as well, both. I'm read a lot of horror. I would say some of my writing is quite horror adjacent. And movies, again, like I feel like all of my young passions have come full circle now because there's been such a resurgence in
there really
horror,
has,
really
yeah.
good quality horror movies lately. Yeah. So I could name so many recently that I've just been so shocked with the quality and how well they've been received. I love it.
My husband is a big fan of those. I not so much. Like I used to be able to watch them when I was younger, but now that I'm older, I'm like, you can watch those on your own, buddy. That like that is not for me.
That's fair. And some of them are getting quite confronting now. I think we're pushing the boat out further and further with what shocks audiences. But no, I absolutely love. I'm anything horror will get my attention immediately.
So working as a copywriter, you're writing a decent amount. What made you decide to write the novel?
I started writing creatively. Like that was always the main game. And it's like everybody who works as a server in a restaurant wants to be an actor. It's the same thing. Every copywriter wants to be a novelist. We're all just getting by with the skills that we have. So I think I was writing the book as a passion project over about 7 years. So it was certainly not, it didn't come to me in a rush and I just put it all down on the page. There were many, many years of working in cafes on the weekend, whenever I felt like it, just putting it together from even just the luxury of thinking, oh, that's a new idea. I'll work on that for a couple of weeks. And if it doesn't pan out, I'll just put it in something else. You know, those kind of things that just take time. That was how I wrote the book. And I think it was really during the COVID years here in Melbourne, because we had a lot of time at home during COVID. That's when I finished the manuscript properly and started thinking about getting it published.
So when you were writing the story, did you have a plan in place, or did you just kind of write it and let the lore and the story lead you?
A bit of both. So, because it's such a complex novel structurally, there are three timelines
It is
that kind of
very
interweave with each
complex.
other. I had to do some planning. Like, I had to know, especially when it came to, given the structure, the rate of disclosure. So, kind of who knows what and when. That keeps that tension and the appropriate level of cliffhangeriness at the end of every chapter. But the rest, a lot of it came, a lot of the best scenes and a lot of the best character moments came as I was writing it. But I think what I really, one of the things I really wanted from the get-go was that sense of a love story behind the events of the, quite a dark narrative for the rest of it.
Well, and so when you're writing, do you have anything that kind of gets you like into focus? Like, do you have any rituals or habits, or is it just you get out of like a certain space and go to another? Because every author that I talk to, which I tell every author that I interview, this is one of my favorite things about these interviews, is everybody's process is so different. Like the end result is the same. Like you get a book, but it's such a vast like variety of ways that authors get like in the zone for things.
I have to, and this will sound quite strange, I kind of have to surprise myself with it a little bit, in the sense that I will, I can't have my phone in the room with, it's just, that can't happen. Just the level, and I'm so easily distracted, I'm ashamed to
Same.
say. But yeah, but the best way I found is to have it ready immediately without having to take any extra steps. So as soon as I turn on my laptop or wherever I am, the writing is what comes up straight away, because as soon as I start reading, I'll see something that needs doing and I'll get into it that way. Whereas if I sit down and plan it out and say, this is what I need to accomplish today, and then get lost doing something else within the magic, it's a very different feeling. It's not a, it's you feel almost like you failed at your goal, and that's very demotivating for me. So I think I kind of have to sneak up on myself a little bit in that sense. But once I'm doing it, I think it's I can I think at most writers, I can lose hours and not realize where the time went. It's very absorbing. So once I'm in it, I just need to stay in it.
You just need to get into it.
So, and that's the hardest thing. And sometimes it's actually better if there are other people around.
Oh,
Just
really?
for a sort of, yeah, for me, I think a sense of kind of accountability, weirdly. So I'm never just sitting there staring into space, or I'm thinking, oh, I'm on the clock, like there's people here. So in a cafe, or I go to my local library a lot, just because they have there are people around and there's activity, but I'm not involved in it. So I'm kind of in
Well, when they're
public,
there,
but
they have a
not.
purpose. Like they're motivated to do things, so it helps you keep that motivation as well.
Yes, it feels like a working space. And I mean, cafes, I've worked in loads of cafes as a coffee maker, waiter. So like it's a very familiar environment to me. So it's quite comforting to be in that space as well. And
So
weirdly
what?
not disruptive.
Well, I mean, that's great. I'm a big fan of people watching, so things like that, like I have a hard time staying focused. Like I can be in like the back corner of something like that and not a lot of people around and I'm fine, 'cause I mean, I like my coffee. But yeah, I like to people watch too much.
It's and it does. I mean, it's tempting, but again, once I hook into whatever's happening on the page, I do find it quite easy to sort of sink into that and stay in it. It's just
So
getting there.
let's Oh, that's fair. So let's talk The Red Winter. It comes out February 24th, 2026. So when I first dove into this book, I read the author foreword. And as I was reading it, I was like, oh, this is not Cam Sullivan talking. Like, this is a character talking. Like, I thought that was a really interesting choice doing that.
I've had a couple of people contact me saying I've read the foreword of your book and I live near Florence and I'd love to get a copy. And I'm like, I'm not actually, I don't live in Florence. It's the character. But I think I really wanted to start it that way. So just to introduce that sense that this is a real person writing a memoir straight away. I didn't want me up front at all. So in a way, I'm kind of glad that I tricked some people. But yes, it was never intended to be meant to be.
I read it 3 times because I was like, wait, this does not, I don't think that's him. And then I was like, but based on his like bio, like I know he was in Italy for a while, so maybe it was. But
Yeah.
then as then I reread and I was like, nope, definitely not him. So in Italy, did you have a favorite area?
I think around Florence. So when I lived in Italy, I did a student exchange mostly in Italy. I've been back quite a few times, but that area around Florence, Tuscany, and Florence itself, I absolutely fell in love with. I've only been there for very short periods of time, but it's so and this is a lot of Italy, so it's not limited to just Florence, but the history there is so alive. You're walking through the same streets that from the 1500s, 1600s that are, and the walls, like the original Roman walls are still like the incredible history there. So that area definitely, if there was a city that in Italy that I would live in, it would be Florence, absolutely.
I went when I was in college. We had like we took an art history class, and part of the sorry, my phone is ringing. Can you hear my phone ringing through?
No, I
Okay, good. Oh, I'm so sorry. Hold on just a second. I gotta go
No,
stop
that's
it because
fine.
it's like
No,
messing me up.
I'm in Saturday morning mode, so it's really no issue.
Okay. Mike's gonna have to remove that because whoops, I haven't had that one happen before. But anyway, so when I was in college, my art history class, like part of the class was to go to Italy. And so we went to Rome and Florence and then Venice. And I loved Florence. It was my absolute favorite thing. Not that the other places weren't amazing and wonderful to experience, but there was just something about the city of Florence that it's like so tangible that I
Yeah,
just loved it.
and it feels so intimate as well. It's a very everything's walkable. Everything you feel like the people who lived there at that time most definitely were doing exactly what you're doing when you're there. It's just yeah, it's so alive. And as a massive history dork, I absolutely loved it. And the fact that there's Dante Alighieri, that famous poet. Is from Florence, and so much of it is in his work, which I also studied later at university after I left Italy. There's so much of that kind of literary pride and history there as well. Absolutely fell in love with it.
Well, in this story itself is very steeped in the history because, as you said, there's 3 different timelines, which it's they kind of mirror each other, but they don't mirror each other at the same time. So it is a little complex, and like you definitely have to read closely because you're like, which timeline am I in currently? But then like as it plays out, like, but I think part of that is the fact that they do kind of mirror each other. So it's like, but as like you get through those chapters, like it really makes sense, like why the mirroring happens. Was it really hard to structure the story that way?
Yes. That's definitely like technically the hardest part of the novel, and I'm in the process of writing the second novel. Which has the same structure, and now I'm wondering why I did this to myself. But a lot of the choices of where to break the narrative and switch back and forth between the timelines, a lot of those decisions. I mean, I had this incredible pin board with 3 timelines, sort of post-it notes, all interweaving with each other and coming together in various ways. But I think. That mirroring that you're talking about, the way that it kind of flips back and forward, I think really effectively. You can thank my editor and my agent for their input on a lot of that. And I really need it at the point where I was sort of, it was a final draft, kind of final manuscript stage. I really needed that external input because I knew the story so well. That again, those points of disclosure, like who knows what at this point and when, like, can they have this conversation or are they talking about things that nobody's aware of it? So those kind of questions, I found it really hard to answer because I'm so deeply into it. Whereas for them, they were a manuscript reasonably fresh every few months, and they could say why they were supposed to know and if something was strange to them. But yeah, I think a lot of the final structure is yeah, you can thank them for that much more than me.
So when you were writing it, did you write like each timeline separately, or did you kind of bounce back and forth between the timelines as well?
So the main two timelines, the sort of 1760s, 1780s timelines, I wrote together mostly. And the sort of flashback addendum timeline and sort of Joan of Arc era, I wrote all on its own. And just kind of injected that where it was kind of speaking to the main events of the story at the time. And in my original manuscript, they're all in very different typefaces. So I could immediately see where I was, which they have toned down a lot in the printed version because obviously it looks quite strange. But yeah, I think I had to do it that way just so that I wasn't getting ahead of myself in either of those main storylines.
So we had like Sebastian is our main character who kind of leads the story. He's like the main character, not that there's not other main characters, but he's so in the premise is the idea of this beast that exists and a monster slayer and all these intricate things that are combined with like Sebastian's story. Where did you get the inspiration for this?
And the history itself is, it's, and I've always been, I studied history, I've always been fascinated with history, particularly these sorts of events. So the Beast of Gévaudan, which is what the story is based on, very loosely, was a real historical event. And it's insane. The actual history on its own, with no fantastical overlay, is absolutely crazy. There was a wild animal, a mysterious animal that was attacking people in the south of France in the 1760s, so kind of 25, 30 years before the French Revolution. And it killed in a space of sort of 3 years, over 100 people, attacked over 200 people. There were witnesses. It was, even now, this would be an event of national significance. Like it was a really strange thing to be happening, terrible thing to be happening. And lots of people got involved at an official level. So the king and the church and the local authorities, the local nobility. So there's lots of documentation. There's these sort of wanted posters with these crazy animals because no one could quite describe what they thought it was. There are sort of letters from the king's representatives back to him saying how, they're kind of slipping into despair because they can't help and this beast keeps killing people. And there's a really, it paints a really vivid picture of what it was like. And so from there, I, yeah, just thought the addition of a sort of pansexual monster hunter was exactly what was needed. And I wanted a kind of a historical tour guide in a way in the main character. So Sebastian is, he shares his body with a sort of malicious spirit called Samadel, who he lives forever as a result of this kind of strange union that he's involved in. So he is writing to us essentially from the present day about these events, a sort of memoir of his. And that I think all of the character kind of arose from that. He's a little bit kind of bookish. He lots of footnotes in the book. He's written it almost as a kind of historical memoir with a lot of, I guess, humor and personal commentary and little
Well,
asides.
and there's this like biographical element to it as well.
Yes. Yeah, and that's, I think, what I wanted more than a kind of sort of straight fantasy retelling of a historical period. I wanted it to sound like somebody's life, and he was perfect for that.
Well, and as we get more of Sebastian's story, we like learn that he and Antoine, who we meet in multiple timelines as well, like they had a relationship like in the past. And it's one of those characters like Antoine, like when we first meet him, like he's starts off almost as like a naive boy. But like when we re-meet him, he is not that at all. Like he's not exactly a good person.
No, and I think, I guess I wasn't thinking about it in terms of sort of traditional romance story beats, in terms of, you know, ordinarily that sort of story would resolve in a particular way if you want your happily ever after, or sort of whatever ending you're going for. But I wanted the love story to be complicated and realistic, in inverted commas, for a kind of fantasy, supernatural romance, as realistic as it could be, in terms of people make some terrible decisions, not just in terms of their relationships, but also in general life terms, people make some really dark decisions in the story. And the consequences of those were, I think, would change people. So in the sort of 20-year gap between these two timelines, in which their love story has kind of been on hold, I think those changes, without giving too much away, would make a reconciliation really difficult.
Well, and especially a lot of the choices that he made after the fact. Like, there's just so much of a disconnect between them. Like, when they re-meet, that like it wouldn't make sense for them to come back together almost.
Yeah, and I think it's encapsulated. They have a conversation where the events of the Red Winter, so in the Beast of Jevagon timeline, they say it ruined them. And I think it not just it ruined their relationship, but it kind of ruined them as people. They realized that they had to make these terrible decisions, and they now live with that, the consequences, and they can't go back to that naive, boyish adventure state that they're kind of in at the start, which I liked because it seemed true to life in their story, and also because it's another element of that doomed love story that we, I think, we all love in supernatural
Well,
romances.
it well, and it almost reads more of a tragedy than a romance in a way.
Yeah, and I think it was really hard to find any other way to tell the story, given that it's just before the French Revolution, it was full of so much bloodshed. Yes, an incredible time of, I guess, balancing the books for the people who rose up and threw off their oppressors, but a very bloody time, and I think a real reckoning with, which is one of the themes of the book, I would say overall, that kind of beast within of that terrible side of our nature that just wants to take what other people have with violence. So yeah, I think it is a tragedy in a lot of ways, but I like the love story, even with Sebastian's kind of overarching kind of timeless perspective on things. The love story still matters to him, and that's why he wants to tell the story.
No, and I think that the way that it played out, because like Sebastian essentially is in all of these timelines, like in some form or another, like I think it really works out that way, because you figure he's gonna have great loves, like because he is like an entity that is never going away, and he will learn from like the past choices that he's made.
Yeah, and I think for him, people have said to me, oh, he still falls in love like a teenager. Like he still gets infatuated and has these kind of crazy thoughts. You know, surely he's moved beyond that. But I think the real enduring love story in his life is always Samadel, the demon that lives with him. They are, I guess, in a lot of ways, like an old married couple. And he knows that's never going away. And will, and so that's his priority. And he's also been essentially raised by a voice in his head that encourages him to indulge his worst impulses. So I think in some ways he's emotionally still as vulnerable, as complex, and as needy as anyone. His long lifespan doesn't make him immune to that at all.
Yeah, but the complexity of this story and the way that you tell it, like it just it's a lot, but like it worked really well. Like, and I think that had you not told it in the three timelines, like I don't think the story would have had an impact in the way that it does.
Yeah, I think that's why when I'm talking about the kind of disclosure elements, I kind of wanted, especially with Sebastian and Anton's love story, I wanted that to be complete. And I wanted, I guess we'll be going on this journey with them. I wanted everyone to care about that and enjoy it and see how special it was before then experiencing the devastation of what happened afterwards. So I think the structure really helped bring that home in the sense that Sebastian never really says what happened until we've seen that relationship run its course, and then you understand. And it's dreadful. I mean, I think everyone really acted quite understandably with the information they had. But I think I have never written a love story like that before, and I think having a slightly more formal structure to it really helped me as well.
So what's next for you?
I am writing a second Sebastian Samuel Olivia story set in a different time period with another very similar structure, three timelines, telling another big case from Sebastian's past.
Fun. When do you know when we can have or expecting that, or are you allowed to
Not
say?
yet.
'Cause not yet.
No, I mean, I, yes, I, no, I've got no specifics on that as yet. And there's no, I don't think there's any specific timeline anywhere on that yet. But not too long, not too long.
Well, that is exciting for you.
It is.
So, thank you so much for taking time out of your morning, because it is night for me, but morning for you. But
Thank
thank you for
you.
taking time out to stop and chat with me. I appreciate it.
Thank you very much. It's been an absolute pleasure.
And until next time, happy reading, everybody.
Find us on Instagram at Buzzing About Romance or on Twitter at Buzzing Romance. If you like the podcast, please leave a review. If you'd like to support us directly, join the Bookcase and Coffee Patreon and receive exclusive content only available to Patreon members. Check out bookcaseandcoffee.com for our on-the-shelf show notes.